Hey, what's up? Welcome back to Past Gas. This week, we are talking about great moments in turbocharging history. This is a really fun one, just a collection of stories, a grab bag, if you will, about everyone's favorite engine modification.
We're going to be talking about the onset of those whirly boys until their advent in racing in the 70s and 80s, and even up until our modern-day turbos, which are super sick.
That's right.
Make the best noises, give us that precious boost. And we got our boy Tristan Kim here today.
Hello.
Let's get into it. The year is 1984, and you're standing in a serene, idyllic, snow-covered forest at the break of dawn. It'd almost be fit for a postcard, except for the fact that you're huddled together with hundreds of other people outlining the curve of a narrow, snow-covered road. The sheer level of anticipation is measured in the crowd's silence. A smattering of murmurs can be heard as the sun slowly rises. You start to hear the minor, offbeat roar of something that sounds truly out of this world as the murmurs cease. The road isn't constant. It's frequently interrupted by a chattery, high-pitched hiss. And both noises are getting louder. Suddenly, a white and yellow coupe with headlights strewn across its nose rages into the picture, sideways, with snow flying off all four tires. The offbeat roar has completely enveloped every single person's eardrum within 100 feet. And then, it's gone. The crowd roars as the Audi Sport Quattro S1 disappears into the distance. The Audi, like so many of the monstrous Group B cars of the era, made incredible amounts of power from a relatively small engine, thanks to the technology known as turbocharging. The history of turbos is deeply storied, and today, we're going to talk about why. Who invented turbocharging? How did it come to impact everything from motorsport to road cars? And what cars and moments have defined this technology? Today on Past Gas, it's the history of turbocharging.
Past Gas Podcast, it's about cars, it's not about forts.
Turbos.
Turbo-targing.
Turbo-targing.
That's good stuff.
That was good.
Appreciate that.
Hey, welcome back to Past Gas, everybody. My name is Nolan Sykes. Joining me today are just a smattering of technical issues with our headphones. But besides that, we also have Joji Weber.
What's up? Keep it juiced, ladies and gentlemen. It's time for charging.
And we have a new guest in the studio, a new team member, a new face.
A beautiful face. Look at that.
Very talented. Mug. Very goofy guy. I'm really stoked to have him in here this week. We got Tristan Kim.
What's up, dog?
What's up, dude? Hey, Nolan. What's up?
Hey.
I'm sweaty, bro.
Don't spill your coffee again.
Yeah.
Wow. I spilled my coffee absolutely everywhere before we started.
Yeah. Tristan is new to Donut, but you've been doing your own sort of automotive videos. You've been making a ton of stuff on TikTok.
Mm-hmm.
You might recognize him from TikTok. You've been working on your S14. You've been doing a drift build. You also have a VIP,
the VIP.
Lexus LS 400. 400 or 430? It's a 430. LS
430. 400.
A
400?
Okay.
400.
400.
Mm-hmm.
91? It's a 98. So I say pack the boys in the LS4 and we can find a place to go.
Nice. He also raps too. He's really good at freestyling.
Yeah, if you see him on the street, ask him. No,
you gotta make me do it. Start like put a camera in my face and start yelling at me to freestyle, and you're probably gonna get a really good response.
Yeah. So, Tristan, you might have seen him on the channel already. Please give him a warm welcome to the show. We looked high and low.
Nice.
Whoa.
Pun not intended.
Yeah.
But honestly, when we saw your stuff, we're like, we got to get this guy on the channel.
We're like, man, cars are this guy's wheelhouse. We got to get him up to speed.
Yeah. And he can introduce some science to this garage, you know? So, no, it's been, and you brought your own money pits with you.
Yes, dude.
Yeah. So, yeah, really excited to have you.
I'm so stoked to be here. This is an absolute dream job. Like, even right now on this podcast, I got to acclimate. I'm nervous.
Even now,
I'm just like, hello. That's
great. I mean, this is one of my favorite parts of doing this job is like the podcast is where we can kind of like relax a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, we are on camera, but really it's like theater of the mind here. You know, that's how I think.
We turn the cameras on and we let it go.
I'm a podcasting purist, you know.
Yeah.
Chop it up, have some fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a new segment I want to pitch. We'll see if you guys listening or watching will be receptive to it. But I get a lot of DMs that this podcast is one of people's favorites to listen to on a road trip.
Love that.
Or maybe on a long commute. What do you do in a road trip? You snack, right? I want to review road trip snacks. And okay. You guys send us stuff. I've had people send me stuff from Canada, from Australia. If you have a unique road trip snack, please send it to us. I'll put the address. You can send it down here in the video. We will review it and tell you if it's roadworthy.
They're just going to send in like a carton of Newports and like a 12-pack like a 12-pack of Diet Coke. And we're like, okay.
Sorry. You're reaching for something.
This week, I have something special. I have a story behind it too.
Okay.
Ooh.
This is a snack from Ireland. It's called Tato Banshee Bones.
No way.
Tato Banshee Bones.
Is that a year-round product that they sell?
Look at the dude at the top.
It's a banshee. It's a woman.
Look at the dude
at the top.
Oh, that's
Tato Man.
That's Tato?
Yeah. Doesn't he look like the guy from Smiling Friends?
Yes, dude, he does.
It's incredibly similar, yeah.
So Tato is basically like Lay's from Ireland.
Okay.
They make a bunch of different types of chips. This is a special one I think they did for... Halloween a couple years ago, and it was so popular that they had to bring it back. But we found out about it in Ireland, and we just went crazy with it. We bought them everywhere because I think they're pretty good. I want to get your guys' take on them, though.
Let me see what these banshee.
Yeah,
bones
let's crack it open. Take a look. Take a whiff.
Yo, what? These don't look like banshee bones.
Tristan's really
dude. It literally
his whole nose in there. Oh.
Okay, so this
okay,
is
okay. So they look like kind of like Cheetos.
Yeah, they look like
they look like Cheetos puffs.
Okay,
but yeah, like
Cheetos puffs,
yeah. Like
they
baby food.
Salt and vinegar flavored. Kind of
like they are like a bone.
Yeah, let it wash over your tongue.
Mm. It's a salt and vinegar Cheetos puff.
Mm. Yeah, you think it's pretty good?
Mm.
I like it. It's got a bit of a packing peanut, like
so,
chewiness.
Yeah.
But I like it.
Dude, look, I gotta get more.
Yeah, isn't it addictive?
That's
it's
really
so good.
Oh my God, I gotta house a whole bag of these.
So there's an Irish shop somehow near my house, and I was like, oh, I'm gonna go in here with Max, who went to Ireland with us. We asked just on a whim, we're like, do you guys have Tato Banshee Bones? And she was like, yes, we do. This is the first time they've been imported into the US, so this is like a special batch. So
and they expire in 2 weeks. So
oh shit. Well, we gotta aim. Based on like messiness, ease of eating, satiation.
Okay.
I don't know if that's a word, but how do you rank this out of 10 as like a road trip snack?
I'm giving that a strong. I'm gonna say like an 8.
Wow, 8 out of 10 coming out of
why.
The gate fast.
There is a little bit of dust, but it's not crazy on the fingers. But also, like, satiation-wise, I feel like I can eat a whole bag of those and not feel gross after eating it.
It's like popcorn.
Yeah, it gives you, like, something to do, but not feel disgusting afterwards.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm guilty of, like, rating things way too high, and then I have no ceiling after that. Mm. So even though I love these to death, I could eat a gigantic bag of them. I think I'm going to rate them... 7.4 out of 10. But they're so good. I cannot overstate how good these things are.
Tato, please. We gotta reach out to Tato.
Yeah.
And get a sponsorship.
My boy
or something.
Tato.
Tato Banshee Bones. So anyways.
I can already see like a little Irish kid walking into a store.
Yeah.
Like, do you have any Tato Banshee Bones? And it's like, oh yes, little Irish boy.
One more and then I'm done. Do you want one last one?
I've had like 7 already.
The ultimate road trip snack. Top of the list. 10 out of 10 is always going to be beef jerky.
Mm-hmm.
Beef jerky.
It gives
you
everything you need.
No mess.
Mm-hmm.
Protein.
Mm-hmm.
I do dock points though because it's so expensive at gas stations.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Like $14 for like a little bag of jerky. What are we doing here?
Yeah.
As opposed to what, like a dollar for some banshee bones?
Yeah.
I brought you that Wagyu beef jerky a while ago.
Oh yeah.
And it was so wet.
It was very wet, but it was very good.
It was like a tongue.
Mm. Ew.
Yeah, it was kind of gross.
Was it just leaking oil?
Because, like, Wagyu's so marbleized.
Yeah.
They can only dehydrate it so much.
It is delicious, though.
It was good.
Was it soft?
It was really soft. Mm-hmm. But it was honestly, like,
was
tongue
like
texture.
It gets to a point where it's, like, so indulgent that it's no longer good.
I just want, like, some part of it to be not so
like
fatty.
Beef jerky technology, I feel like, has improved so much over the past
20 years.
Future
is now, man.
I remember when I was a little kid, beef jerky was, like, dry as shit and like really hard.
Yes.
And you had to chew
it was Slim Jim. And I feel like Slim Jim has even gotten better since we were a kid.
I think that's very true, too. Probably because there's, like, laws passed against the chemicals that they're using.
Yeah, it has to be at least half meat.
Yeah.
No, dude. Yeah. I actually think they've gotten worse.
Really?
You think so?
Yeah, Slim Jims do not taste as nearly as good as when they had those, like, schizophrenic commercials of people like losing it.
Didn't they have like a Slim Jim mascot where it's like,
yeah,
a
it was
dude
the guy
like,
from Power Man 5000.
It was
no,
he did look like he's from Static X.
What's yeah. funny is like oh, all Static the mascots X. from that era were just tweaking,
yeah.
yeah,
they were losing their minds, screaming like a type of person you'd be terrified if
you're
you
like,
saw
that's
him.
That's the kind of guy I want to be,
yeah. It's like, oh, and you sell beef sticks,
yeah. Are they just beef sticks?
Yeah,
did you give a number rating on that?
I would rate it a solid 6.
Oh.
6? Okay.
Considering that beef jerky's in the 10. Because the beef jerky has everything you need except for the price.
Oh, okay, so if you have a road trip snack that you'd like to send us.
Yeah.
And it can't be alive or like gross.
It can't be expired. We're not going to eat expired stuff.
P.O. Box 84, Inglewood, California, 90306. Again, that's P.O. Box 84, Inglewood, California, 90306, and we will rate your road trip snacks.
Send us your Vegemite, your shrimp chips,
shrimp
your
chips.
Crab cakes, whatever. We'll rate them.
They're going to send lutefisk. You know what that is?
Oh, man.
Like the hissing can of like fermented fish.
Yeah, shark, buried shark.
Like a very good road trip.
No.
I can guarantee, because it's so gross, people are going to send it in.
There was that guy that opened it up in his car. Did you see that video?
Yeah.
And it sprayed everyone. He was like, oh.
He was getting poison damage, dude.
Oh, here we go. What's happening? Oh, that's the worst smell I've ever smelled in my life.
All right, so let's get into our story this week. Again, great moments in Turbocharger history. Going to be a fair amount of different stories here. And I'm really excited. We have some history with the Turbo here at Donut.
Yeah.
My first foray into that was when we turbocharged the Z low car back in 2019 now.
And that was a journey.
It was a journey. It definitely ruined that car. It made, after all the work, it made like 300 horsepower. So we gained like 30 horsepower maybe. It was really cool. It sounded cool, but definitely ruined that car. Then our Subarus, the turbos on those, pretty fun. Pretty into that.
Yeah.
I like turbos. I'm into turbocharged cars.
I prefer turbos over supercharging.
Hmm. It's just the noise, man. At the end of the day, it's like a holistic experience. You get in, you hear like whistling.
Yeah.
So what? You just got 30 horsepower. It's badass. It's cool, man.
It is cool.
We're only making like 3 pounds of boost with that turbo.
3 pounds?
Yeah. Does it still sound good?
It sounds sick.
There you go, bro.
Sick wherever we went. It's like, oh, that thing's nasty. Mm-hmm. But it's still like kind of slow.
That's like a Coleman like air mattress pump makes that much.
Anyway, okay, let's get into this. So, like many crucial pieces of auto technology, the turbocharger owes its existence to a single man, Alfred Bucci.
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 Bucci. Bucci or Bucci, depending on how you knew him. Was born on July 11th, 1879 in Winterthur, Switzerland. Right from the get-go, he was set up for engineering success. His dad was a chief executive at the engineering firm Sulzer, which still exists to this day and has covered basically every corner of modern engineering. No doubt, thanks to his father, Alfred was deeply interested in engineering from a young age. At 20, he enrolled in the Federal Polytechnic Institute in Zurich to pursue engineering professionally. After graduating, he worked in Belgium and England for a couple years, then became fascinated with the concept of improving the internal combustion engine's overall efficiency. Again, this is like the early days of the internal combustion engine too. So he's like on trying to be on the cutting edge.
Mm. It wouldn't be too hard to improve like this early engine stuff. Like the efficiency was not great.
Yeah, that's true. Bucci conceptualized using spent exhaust.
I think it might be Bucci.
Bucci, I know. I'm just saying Bucci's funny.
Bucci's fun, dude.
Yeah.
But if Joe wants Bucci, we're going to give him some Bucci. Bucci conceptualized using spent exhaust gas to spin a turbine, which would drive another turbine that could pull in and compress fresh air to feed the air-fuel mixture into the cylinder. The result would be a higher efficiency number and higher power output. In 1905, he filed the first turbocharging patent that covered, quote, a combustion machine consisting of a compressor, the turbine compressor, a piston engine, and a turbine in sequential arrangement. Essentially, the basic recipe for the turbocharger we know today. But The world wasn't quite ready for the technology, and over the next decade, Alfred designed and built his first fully operational turbodiesel engine while working as chief engineer of Sulzer, the same firm that his dad had worked for. The engine was a bit rough around the edges. It worked, but it wasn't quite ready for mass use. Before the turbo could walk, it needed to fly.
Like boats.
Yeah.
Like they put it on scooters before cars.
I don't know, but that's not where I'm going.
That's, you said fly.
Fly?
Well, have you ever been to the skate park and seen scooters fly?
Oh, I think I did go down to Venice one time and see a scooter kid going crazy.
Was he really good?
Yeah.
Nice.
Dude, a scooter, have you ever taken a scooter to the shin, like a razor scooter?
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah.
Have you? There's a guy that like is like in the pain Olympics with that. You like put him on like a Ferris wheel,
But oh, he's on TikTok.
Called? Yeah, he's on TikTok.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. He just like pummels his shins until he can't feel anything.
Does it look like he's making money from this?
I think so.
Yeah.
What a great way to make money.
Who would sponsor him?
Razor.
Razor.
They want to, their whole marketing campaign is, are the products we make are painful.
I remember.
Sponsored by Purdue.
How old was I? Maybe like 8 years old, 8 or 9 years old when Razor scooters were becoming like super popular, and I really wanted one for my birthday, and I got a scooter, but it was not a Razor. It was called an Urban Scooter was the brand.
Did it have big wheels?
That's a U.S. Polo Association scooter.
And then my sister, a couple months later, got a Razor.
Ah, damn it.
But I mean, I still rode the Razor. What I did actually... The main difference between the two is that the bearings on the Razor were like way better than my Urban scooter. So I took the wheels off her scooter and put it on mine.
No way.
Dude.
Did she freak out? Was she upset?
Nah, she was.
She probably wanted to go slower than you.
I was like, hey, my wheels are red. Don't you want red? Yours are clear. Like, that's boring. You want red ones, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
sure.
Want red
and I was like,
hell
yeah.
Yeah.
Give me those Abex.
I should have put some freaking reds on them.
Oh,
some
red
Swiss
bearings.
Bone reds.
Yeah.
Bone Swiss, yeah.
Ceramics, dude.
I never got those for any of my...
I just bought some for the first time last year, ironically, with my last skateboard. I've wanted them my whole life.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're like $100.
They're expensive.
Versus like
the reds
$30.
Are like 15.
Yeah.
The ceramics are $100?
Mm-hmm.
No
90
way.
Something. They might be way more expensive than they were when I was a kid, but there's no way my parents were ever going to buy me... Mm-mm. $90 bearings for my...
It'll make you go faster. It's dangerous.
Yeah. My dad spray-painted helmets required on my lawn tramp, and it was legally binding.
That's pretty funny.
Well, now that I have a kid, I'm like, oh, I get it. I don't want this.
Yeah.
I'm trying to protect his head, you know? He doesn't give a shit. He doesn't know how dangerous it is.
So ever since the Wright brothers' first flight...
Oh, planes, not scooters. Uh-huh.
The early 20th century was going absolutely bonkers over aircraft technology. Every industrialized nation wanted a piece of it, and advancements were moving incredibly fast. Between experimental, commercial, and military use, airplanes were massively in vogue by 1918. But one big hurdle needed addressing, and that was air density. The higher the elevation, the lower the air density, and thus the lower your power output. General Electric, particularly one of its engineers by the name of Dr. Sanford Moss.
That's a sick name.
Mm-hmm.
First tested a turbocharged aircraft engine at Pikes Peak in 1918. The very same Pikes Peak where engineers of all varieties are pushing the envelope and the 102-year-old hill climb event to this day.
Episode 58 of Past Gas is on Pikes Peak if you want to learn more about
that.
An
early one, man.
It's early.
That's a good one, though. That was fun. I remember that. Moss's methods were ahead of their time. Rather than enlisting test pilots and exposing them to the immense amount of danger, he loaded a 27-liter Liberty V-12 and its dynamometer onto a massive Packard truck and shipped it out to Colorado Springs via rail. Then he and his team unloaded it and went to work assembling and running countless test runs up and down the mountain, rough weather and all. The engine in question produced 354 horsepower near sea level without a turbo system bolted up, and a miserable 230 horsepower at 14,000 feet atop Pikes Peak. Then, Moss installed the turbo, which improved performance drastically at high elevation, making 377 horsepower.
Sick. 27 liters.
So big.
Man.
After more development, Moss and his team dropped this engine into a Lapeyre biplane in 1921 to attempt breaking the international altitude record, achieving 40,000 feet in the process. This is double what the LePerec had reached naturally aspirated and established turbocharging as the way forward in aeronautical technology for several decades to come.
That's crazy. In 1921, being 40,000 feet in the air?
40,000 feet in a biplane designed in the 1920s. I wonder if they brought an oxygen tank up there with them, because there's no way.
I don't know.
You'd have
people
to have
are just built different
mask.
Back then.
Yeah, they had bigger lungs from all those cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
2 years later, Buki was finally able to put his original concept into practice. By then, it had been refined and tweaked enough to garner attention and employment from Swiss engineering firm Brown, Bovary, and C.
BBC.
The Swiss Locomotive Machine Works contracted BBC to help it produce more power and reduce fuel consumption from an experimental two-stroke diesel engine that the firm was working on. A quandary for conventional internal combustion thinking.
Yeah, that BBC really thrust air into
your intake.
With Buki at the helm of the project, the world's first production heavy-duty exhaust gas turbocharger was produced, the VT-402. Then, only a few years later, Germany's Vulcan shipyard debuted the world's first ocean liners possessing turbochargers with the help of BBC and Buki services. The science was proven.
It just took a little bit to get there, but it was there the whole time.
The tooling is what I think is so interesting. Like how fine of those parts are during that era.
Yeah. Yeah. With no computers or anything.
And you're just like, all right, time to put it in the sky.
That's true.
Who wants to do it?
Yeah. And I was like, I'll do it. I'm scared, bro.
This is a guy like sitting in the dark.
He's like, I'll do it. Are you sure?
Dude, you have 7 kids.
Bro, you have like, you have everything to lose. Like, I don't care.
We're going to pay you 12 cents this week.
Put me in the plane. Put me in the flying thing.
Just let me go, dude. Just let me go. So once it was proven as a massive benefit for airplane engines, adding in turbocharging became the preferred method of increasing power and improving their ability to operate at high altitude. Many of World War II's most famous military aircraft possessed turbocharging, including the Boeing B-17 Flying Fortress, the Lockheed P-38 Lightning, and the Republic P-47 Thunderbolt. I didn't know that at all. Dude, my P-38 Lightning?
That's yours? That's your favorite?
It's a twin-engine aircraft. But instead of like the tail coming off of like the cockpit and the fuselage, it's got two separate tails.
I love that one.
Those are dope.
Dude.
I didn't know it was that was my plane of choice back when I was playing War Thunder all the time. The technique you need for that was to climb up really high and then dive down on people.
Oh.
And use your momentum to climb again. If you got in a turn fight with people, you're kind of screwed. You had to dive and dip, basically.
Yeah.
Great plane. I didn't know it was turbocharged. That's sick as hell. That makes me like it even more.
And that was already a goated plane for you, wasn't it?
It's goated with the sauce, as the kids say.
Mm-hmm. Kids from 2017.
I know. I'm 31 now, dude.
Dude, Max said something to me the other day that wasn't intended as a big dig, but it made me feel so old. I said something about he mentioned a helicopter, and I did the helicopter, helicopter. You know that meme? He's like, dude, you're the king of memes from 2 years ago. And I'm like, damn. Cuts deep.
On Skibbity, dude.
He also got me a Skibbity onesie for my baby, and I was like, this is the most Max thing.
Okay, so some aircraft even used a system of integrating both a supercharger and a turbocharger known as twin charging. And while turbos quickly became an established technology for aircraft, their move to road-going vehicles was off to a much slower start. Swiss company Schweizer Maschinenfabrik Sarer was the first company to use the technology in a road vehicle in 1938, though without success. But after World War II...
What does that mean, without success? It just didn't...
It didn't work, I guess, or...
So they just like, put it on, but it didn't work?
Yeah.
It was the Schweizer Maschinenfabrik Sauer.
Do they still have any of those around?
Yeah, I saw one on Craigslist the other day.
Yeah, dude. $2,000 more if you want me.
I know what I have.
If I keep the three-piece wheels.
three-piece wheels.
If I keep the wheels, you pay $2,000 less. By the way, this is the first car that ever had a turbocharger ever from Switzerland.
It doesn't work, but...
I got it on some reps.
No lowballers.
After World War II, the 1950s ushered in a new era of economic boom and highway development in North America and Europe, and the turbo was given a second chance. Commercial truck brands like MAN and Volvo integrated turbocharging into its diesel engine to boost efficiency and performance as Europe slowly rebuilt, and construction equipment firm Caterpillar was among the first to integrate it into product lines for the same reason.
I didn't realize Caterpillar was that old.
What was Europe rebuilding? What happened, man?
America's increasing need for powerful diesel-powered semi-trucks to transport goods across the growing nation brought on an immense amount of turbo development by companies like Detroit and Cummins in the 1950s, but they wouldn't find mass adoption until the early 60s. The early 60s are also when turbocharging started to slowly take hold in passenger vehicle applications. The first two turbocharged production cars actually came from General Motors. Technically, the 1962 Chevrolet Corvair Monza and the 62 Oldsmobile Jetfire V8,
yes,
who had two different 3.5-liter turbo V8s, with the Olds version making 215 horsepower, up from the 155 naturally aspirated V8. GM leaned heavily into the marketing associated with the rockets and airlines of the jet age, even calling its water alcohol coolant turbo rocket fluid.
Dude, is that what you're drinking right now? Turbo rocket fluid?
That's activist.
That's what?
What?
What did you say?
It's turbo rocket fluid, man.
Okay, thanks.
My bad, bro.
Unfortunately for GM, these cars were total flops. The Chevy was known for being mechanically moody and having very pronounced turbo lag, and the 62 Olds was only slightly better in execution with its higher output. Both cars were immensely complicated. They required a special injection system for the water alcohol turbo rocket fluid to run at peak performance.
I'm just imagining like a turbo that doesn't kick in until like 6,000 RPM, and then it kicks in like super hard.
Like some lady in like the 1950s, like, oh my goodness. Yeah. Oh! I'm just flying
like
up
as
the
you're
road.
Turning.
Just launching into like a white picket fence.
And then there's turbo rocket fluid everywhere.
Honey, did you put in the turbo rocket fluid? She's like laid out on the blacktop.
So this turbo rocket fluid mixture only lasted about 250 miles before it needed to be replaced. The injection system also utilized a very complex vacuum system to function, and in the end, GM barely sold 10,000 Jetfires.
I misread that as Jeffries. Like, that's a great name for a car.
The Jeffrey.
The GM Jeffrey.
New, from General Motors. Reliable.
Yeah, it's just okay.
Yeah.
Jeffrey. Over the years, turbocharging hasn't just focused on boosting power and efficiency for aircraft, marine, and everyday transit applications. In fact, some of its most interesting history was written through motorsport, and that's why we're here, folks. In the 1970s, two areas of racing took turbocharging to the next level. You had the Canadian-American Challenge Cup, better known as Can-Am, and, of course, Formula One. Can-Am ran from 1966 to 74, with the second half possessing all the turbocharged craziness that's famous for. In order to compete against big-displacement American V8s, Porsche worked around the series' practically non-existent rulebook and decided to take its Le Mans-winning 917 race car formula and add some boost.
This car is goated.
The first version was the 1972 Porsche 917 3.0, campaigned by none other than Penske Racing. This twin-turbo monster put out around 1,000 horsepower from its 5-liter V12.
Damn.
Not long after, displacement and boost were increased, and the wheelbase was lengthened. Power increased to 1,100 horsepower, but reached as much as 1,500 the following year.
Damn.
When Porsche was finished, they essentially had a low-tech Bugatti Veyron, and they were sheer terrors to drive. They could hit 60 miles per hour in 2.5 seconds, were capable of up to 250 miles an hour, and basically had nothing in terms of safety equipment by
what
modern
year was
standards.
This?
1972.
Holy hell.
Yeah.
We're just pulling out of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And people are going 250 miles an hour.
Fortunate Son is playing at all times.
As Roger Penske recalled about its heyday in Sports Car Digest, quote,
McLaren had dominated for a number of years with big V8s, and Porsche made the commitment to go full forward with a full aerodynamic race car that had lots of downforce, and to use a turbocharged engine that would produce more than 1,200 horsepower. The driver had a control knob that enabled him to add boost as he wished. I watched that car test for half a day, and there was a tremendous amount of throttle lag. Porsche worked on that steadily to improve the lag with evolution of turbos and wastegates. This interview could have been an email.
Porsche's work on reducing lag was an inflection point. Until this time, lag had always been the turbocharger's Achilles heel. Nowadays, most everyday turbocharged cars have seamless power delivery with little to no discernible turbo lag, which is how long it takes the turbo to spin up and provide a noticeable bump in power. But due to the technology available at the time, lag was quite prevalent in turbocharged setups in both racing and streetcar applications. When it came to reaching the checkered flag, professional drivers had to adapt to turbo cars by keeping the revs high enough to spool the turbo enough to make boost and reap the benefits pretty much at all times.
This is like what people have talked about Ayrton Senna's driving.
Mm-hmm.
In the early 90s when they started to show the input of like if he was on the brake or gas or whatever, all his input charts would like spike when he's going around a curve because he's trying to keep that turbo up.
Keep it in the power band.
Yeah.
Over in Formula One, turbocharging first appeared in 1997 when the FIA allowed engines up to 3 liters, if naturally aspirated, or 1.5 liters with turbocharging. The only manufacturer who chose the latter was Renault with its RS01. The French race car made 510 horsepower from its iron block engine, but proved to be too unreliable and retired from most of the races it entered in 1977 and 1978. But Renault was determined to make the tech work. And in 1979, the team earned its first win with the car. They had proven its potential, and from there on out, every manufacturer began diving into turbocharging. Another notable example from the early turbo years of F1 is the 1983 Brabham BMW BT52, which won the world championship. 5 years later, McLaren Honda launched their legendary MP4/4.
Was that the BT52? Is that the four-cylinder that made like 1,400 horsepower?
Four-cylinder turbocharged engine. Nice.
Yeah, made like 1,400 horsepower, boosted to heck, dude.
Mm. Boosted to all heck. Nice pull, Joe. Good job.
I listen to the episodes I'm not in.
By the 1980s, turbocharging had reached every corner of motorsport, particularly in Group B rally racing, where it was practically a requirement to win championships. Cars like the Audi Sport Quattro S1 and Peugeot 205 T16 made a massive impression on rally racing thanks to their turbocharged power plants and all-wheel drive. The 205 in particular claimed a total of 16 wins and 2 world championships, making it the winningest chassis in Group B history. Turbocharging was also quite prevalent in IMSA GT and prototype racing, yet also FIA Group C, SCCA Trans Am, and many more. What are you thinking so far, Tristan? What's on your mind?
What is the quantum leap in engineering that allowed it to have such a higher payback with the turbos?
It sounds like the lag, like the blow-off valves.
I bet fuel injection, too.
Ooh.
I bet that was like the curve.
Yes. Very difficult to turbocharge carbureted cars. Not very fun. But yeah, fuel injection for sure. Because that had been around for a long time as well.
Fuel injection?
Mm-hmm.
Like, but it wasn't really used in production cars.
It wasn't like not how we, every car today fuel injected, but it's all electronic. Yeah. But there were a few mechanical injection systems, like on the
Bosch.
I was going to say the Jetronic. Corvette. On the Corvette back in the day, you could get a fuel injected version. They call it the Fuely. And people bought it, but then they went back to the dealer and got a carbureted. They put the carburetor back on it. It just wasn't as reliable. And because it was newer technology at the time, it was kind of like, it was untested.
Yeah.
It's called a Fuely?
Fuely. I mean, that's the nickname for it. Yeah. Like Corvette, a Fuely Corvette.
I don't want that Fuely stuff.
They're super valuable. Because like all those, like if you have a Corvette fuel injection system, like you could get a bunch of money for that.
Mm.
But also like cars that were sold with it weren't as popular. It's just like because it's a more niche thing, it's desirable.
Do they pay for the system itself to just hold on to it, like as like a
I think dealers would come off and then they would either throw them away or hold, put it in the back room or whatever, and then
paperweight.
Do people put them back on now?
Oh yeah, especially if like you have, if you find a Corvette with a VIN number that came with that system. And yeah,
but isn't it supposed to be unreliable? Do they like work the kinks out now?
I think there's probably tricks and stuff you got to know. Yeah.
Pull up in the Fuely.
People don't drive the cars anyway. They just have them in the garage. You know how it is.
Hey, there's a Fuely in the parking lot.
Is that your Fuely? Yeah, that looks good. Fuely, man.
So, between the late 70s and today, the most prominent overarching theme of turbocharging in passenger cars is based largely on efficiency. We've covered the 1970s oil crisis in the past, but a lot of turbocharged cars that came out shortly after it were in response to it. Automakers put turbos in more cars to improve fuel economy, yet not lose performance in the process. But around the same time, turbocharging became a method to market towards enthusiasts, and manufacturers began to focus on performance applications as well. Cars like the 1975 Porsche 930, the first 911 turbo, went a long way to establishing turbos in a legitimate way to make power in road cars. And though lag wasn't quite solved in the road cars yet, enthusiasts began a sort of addiction to the sudden surge of power compared to more linear power delivery of naturally aspirated engines. Richard Meaden described the sensation best when comparing a 930 against the current generation 992 Porsche 911 for Evo magazine in 2022.
Funnily enough, you're not immediately aware of the 930's turbo. The engine revs freely, but until the turbo builds some boost pressure, you're effectively driving a low-compression engine. What rapidly becomes addictive is sensing the engine starting to come alive and feeling how it begins to get on top of whatever gear it's pulling. It's a delicious sensation of endless elastic propulsion as each looping ratio sends you surging down the road in one effortless rush.
This dude's horny, man.
Dude, he's so horny.
He's
it's
so
crazy.
Horny.
That's a wild
and I like
written,
him, though.
I think it's written pretty well. I like it.
He was pacing back and forth writing that. Dude, just in his underwear. He's like, oh, yeah.
Turbos also found their way into cars with small displacement engines to improve their performance. Consumers fell in love with cars such as the 1978 Saab 9.9 Turbo, possibly the world's first turbo sport compact.
I love this thing.
These things were fun to drive, yet maintained their small car fuel efficiency. In the early 80s, turbos were finally finding their way into American cars as well. The Ford Mustang SVO being a prime example. It crammed 14 PSI of boost, considered a lot for the era, into its 2.3-liter four-cylinder and managed to make the same 175 horsepower as its 5-liter V8 sibling.
Damn, I didn't know that.
Wow, that's cool.
Quick side note, I was like, where does the word turbo come from? Because I'm ADD and I can't just listen to you speak. Turbo is a Latin word, which means whirlwind.
Oh.
And it was first used by naturalist Robert Lovell in 1661.
What?
1661.
As a naturalist.
Naturalist.
That means
to talk about a whirlwind.
Oh, I thought that means that he's naked all the time.
Yeah, what does naturalist mean?
Like a Kirkland biologist, maybe?
I don't know what that means.
Like Kirkland? Like it's like a true value geologist or something? I don't know.
He's a naturalist.
I'm going to get so many Costco lovers hating in the comments and say, Kirkland's actually a really good brand. You shouldn't use it as generic.
It is a good brand.
It is great.
It's boom.
Dude, for my bachelor party, we had a budget. Like, everybody contributed money, right, towards renting the place. The
as
cabin,
you do.
As you do. And also for food. But I think we had, like, a huge over budget on food.
Yes.
Because Dalton.
Your boy?
My boy, who, like, organized the whole thing.
Yeah.
He sent his lovely wife to Costco to get food. And
it's Costco.
She spent, like, $1,500.
Holy.
For how many days?
For 3 days.
For how many people?
9 people.
No.
Dude.
Were you like eating exotic meats or something?
$400 tops.
I know.
What?
What'd you get?
Did you take stuff
everything.
Home?
Everything. We got everything.
Did you, you got to buy coolers to bring all that food home.
Dude, my boys are from the Central Coast. They had coolers. Don't worry about that. But dude, like me and my buddy Marley got to the house first and we're like, I was kind of hungry because we had been driving all day.
Yeah.
And I was like, I want to get some beer or whatever. And we got like some other stuff. We're like, you know, maybe the boys forgot to get eggs. Maybe they forgot to get eggs. We'll just get a little carton of eggs. We get there. I'm like, oh yeah, what's up, dude? Like everyone shows up. I'm like, hey, we just got back from the grocery store. And Dalton's like, you shouldn't have gone grocery shopping. You shouldn't have gone.
Oh my God.
And we're unloading 4 containers of orange juice, 4 gallons of milk, pallets of eggs.
What?
4 things of tri-tip. It was insane, dude. I'll show you the video.
I just broke it down. That's $55 per person per day in groceries.
Yeah.
That's an expensive.
Everybody brought
it.
We did not make a dent in the food, dude.
Did you guys go out to eat a lot?
No, we cooked everything at the house.
That'd be funny as hell if you just went out to eat.
No, we didn't at all. We cooked everything, but it didn't make a dent. And they brought all the food back to their house.
Okay, at least it didn't go to waste.
No,
that's my
I mean that's the thing is like a lot of my boys they have like family stuff, yeah. So like the food will be eaten, but it was just hilarious.
That's insane. Yeah, because I pride myself in like being able to pinpoint like exactly how much food we're gonna need with my boys. Big Bear for a weekend.
Yeah. it was crazy. Also, my boy Cody forgot all of his clothes at his house and had to buy a new wardrobe at Costco.
Do they have at Costko?
Dude, Kirkland. I took my dad to Costco for the first time, knowing that he would love it. He's never been before. Entrance has all these clothes. They all have all this like stuff. He didn't even make it past that first part, and I was like to the dairy section by the time I realized he was gone. He finally catches up to me. He's got 7 pairs of Izod jeans. He's like, these are great. They're so cheap.
I mean, Izod in the 80s.
I know.
Was the big deal.
Man. Yeah. Izod boys.
So now he's pulling up and he's seeing some Izods laid out for like, what, like $10, $20? He's like,
yeah.
It's like FUBU at Walmart.
The 80s also saw the use of turbos as a piece of marketing. Just like, you know, iPod. When iPod came out, everything had I in it.
Yeah.
Now everything's got
accidentlawyer.com.
Yeah, everything's got AI powering it now. Powering in quotes. If a car was turbocharged, it was seen as being special, something with a bit more flair and zest. From the Dodge Lancer, the lesser-known American Econobox Lancer, to the far more exotic Lotus Esprit, marketing led any enthusiast to see a turbo badge and know off the bat that it was something a little spicier than average. Since the 80s, there have been a lot more legendary enthusiast cars that have taken advantage of turbocharging. At the turn of the 90s, the R32 Skyline GTR, FD Miazda RX-7, and A80
Miazda.
Miazda, did I say that?
Just leave it.
Whatever. Miazda and A80 Toyota Supra changed the world's perception of high performance Japanese by offering twin turbocharging. This was to reduce lag by either having one turbo spool up before the other, known as sequential turbocharging, found on the RX-7 and Supra, or each turbo spooling in sync like the GTR and 300ZX. The downside of the former was the complexity. It takes a substantial amount of vacuum lines to make sequential turbocharging work, which affects servicing and long-term reliability. Love my vacuum leaks. Once the late 90s and early 2000s rolled around, Volkswagen and Audi were the main purveyors of boost, especially in enthusiast hands. VW's 1.8-liter turbo engine was legendary in its ability to not only produce good power across the rev band from the factory, but also quite a bit more with some aftermarket tuning. The same goes for the twin-turbo 2.7-liter V6 and the B5 Audi S4. This humble little sedan was considered a supercar killer with just a handful of upgrades and still has a healthy aftermarket to this day. I broke Job's.
Well, how'd you break it?
We were just driving one day, and then the clutch went out. The master cylinder, I think, broke.
That was it, though?
That was it.
That's not too bad.
No, I know. Well, apparently it's a huge pain in the ass to fix that.
Because of the all-wheel drive system?
I think so, yeah. And just the way that Audis are put together. Anyway,
they are expensive.
We were out in the canyons. I had that car. Job was in the money pit. And then we switched, and he rev match shifted the Audi all the way home. Yeah, you were out there, I think.
No, okay. I wasn't, but I heard about him doing that all the way home.
It was pretty badass.
Like, damn. That was when I was like, oh, Job's sick.
Yeah. Between the late 2000s and the early 2010s, Ford and Mazda were renowned for their EcoBoost and MZR four-cylinder engines, which actually shared a lot of similarities as Ford owned a large stake in Mazda for many years. People love to say that like the Mazda 3 or Focus ST are like the same car. They're not, though. Mm-hmm. They're different, I think.
The Mazda Speed 3?
Mm-hmm. Between the tiny turbocharged 1.6-liter Fiesta ST, the Focus ST's 2-liter, and the 2.3-liter in the Mazda Speed 3, Focus RS, and Mustang EcoBoost, these brands proved that efficiency and big power could coexist in everyday enthusiast cars utilizing modern direct fuel injection. Two cars I really wish I bought were the Fiesta ST and the Focus ST. My buddy had a Focus ST that he had tuned to like 300 horsepower at the wheels, and it was so much fun driving that thing around. Just like spinning the tires wherever you go. And then I was at an autocross event one time where
you can fit in a Fiesta.
Well, that's the thing. I can fit in a Focus pretty well. A Fiesta, I got to drive a kind of tuned up Fiesta ST at an autocross event. And I wish I bought that car. But I probably looked ridiculous driving around. It's so small. But it was so much fun. It's like a little go-kart.
Yeah.
They're phenomenal. I feel like I'm just like too late now to get one of those things.
Well, big guys, small car. That's Aura.
That's Aura?
Yes. You pull up and you kind of squeeze out. People are like, whoa.
Yeah. Wow, look how limber he is.
Look how limber he is. Look how stretchy he is.
That shit handle is doing a lot of work.
Yeah. That's really a wear item when I, you know, yeah.
Yeah.
Gotta replace that.
I have always been a fan of the Focus RS. Mm-hmm. That's just like one of my dream cars. I know they're problematic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they posted a lot of weird stuff on Twitter back in the day.
Yeah. What do you mean? What do you mean? What?
Oh, dude. No, I mean, they deleted a lot of tweets. Let's just say that.
Who? Ford?
The Focus RS.
Yeah, really?
Focus RS.
Yeah, before they were on the Chiefs.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
No, I mean, they had some issues with their head gaskets. They were put on wrong from the factory, but I think there's like a recall on those, and then they're okay now. I was looking into getting those in 2020, as you might imagine. You know, I just, Focus RS, I think I didn't get to drive it in the right area when I drove one. We just drove it around the West LA, and I was like, eh, it's okay.
Well, speaking of like American turbocharged cars, like I'm wondering what's going to be the next SR20 out of this generation of four-cylinder turbos.
That's a good question.
I mean, EcoBoost.
You think so?
Yeah.
Does GM do the EcoTechs?
Yeah.
EcoTech, yeah.
Justin is into that idea. He wants to put one in one of his project cars.
I was trying to figure out a way when I had my 95 4Runner, because that engine was ass. I didn't do enough research.
Was it just an absolute dog? Was it slow?
It was slow. It was like 9-10 miles to the gallon and just had gasket issues from the factory. And now people are going to say, oh, they fixed it by 95.
This is a four-cylinder getting 95.
No, it's a V6.
Okay.
Yeah. The four-cylinder that came the gen before was really good.
Mm.
But I was like trying to find a way to put an EcoBoost in it. I was like, I know it's a ton of work. Can I just pay someone to put an EcoBoost in my 4Runner?
I feel like probably not a super common swap. That would be a lot of work.
It'd be so much work. Yeah.
So along this entire way, especially into the 2010s, turbocharging has also represented a more modest approach to aiding internal combustion. It's been used to meet ever-tightening emission standards in very normal everyday cars. An engine that achieves more power when you need it in a smaller displacement package improves its carbon footprint too. So whether it's your mother's Ford Escape or your cousin's Volvo sedan, there's a good chance that turbocharging has combined with other modern technology like direct and fuel injection to make them more efficient and environmentally friendly.
That's funny. When I was younger and I saw the EcoBoost sticker, I was like, oh, what is this, some hippie stuff? Does this mean it's slower? And then I like, you know, grew up and I was like, oh, word. That means it's fast, man. EcoBoost.
I toyed with the idea of getting an EcoBoost Mustang, like a newer one, like 2017 on.
Yeah.
And then putting, Tome makes an exhaust for it, which would be kind of sick. And then getting some sick, some Advans.
It's interesting how the EcoBoost does not get as nearly as much hate as the V6 Mustang.
No, I know.
Not as nearly as much.
Because people, you can make them fast. You can make them, you can like get it tuned to like 400 horsepower, but then it's like, just get a V8, honestly.
Well, it's like scrappy and charming.
Yeah, it's cool.
It's like, there's something really cool.
There's something interesting about it,
an engine with a really small displacement getting the same numbers.
For sure.
As like a V8, because it sort of reminds you of like a small, stocky guy on steroids just going, just going crazy.
It's going nuts.
Dynamite comes in small packages.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That was a story of turbos, Tristan.
Turbos.
How was that? What'd you
think? Nolan, your voice is so buttery. It's got great vibrato.
Thank you.
Same goes to you, my friend.
Vibrato, thank
you. It was an excellent, fun time.
Yeah.
Good. Well,
what's your favorite nickname for a turbo?
Chinese war whistle. Those are the eBay ones.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I like all the nicknames for the eBay ones that we'll come up with for sure.
Yeah.
We got some listener mail this week.
Oh, yeah. Let's read that. This is from Ron.
Ron.
Hello, PassGas.
Hello.
Since the beginning of PassGas, I have been listening mostly on my long commutes. I'm an infantry soldier in the Canadian Army and work about 5.5 hours from home. That's a long commute. Holy shit.
Damn.
On the odd occasion I get a chance to head back home, I love driving, listening to you guys. I guess it's not an all-the-time commute.
He's probably on base for a while. Yeah.
My favorite episodes include the Hell's Angels series.
Thank you!
We always give Nolan shit because we literally start at the bicycle. I think it's a five-part.
It's a five-parter. Yeah. It's a lot. Look, We had to figure out
what this podcast was.
Yeah.
He also likes Group B, Michel Mouton, Pike's Peak, Dakar, and the Baja 1000.
Hell yeah.
I'd love to see you guys do a compilation podcast on the weirdest car setups in racing, like the Tyrrell six-wheeler, the 6x6 Rally Mazda 323, or even the weird things that went up Pike's Peak, like the Toyota Tacoma.
Give it the beans.
Give it the beans. Or the Suzuki Escudo.
That's
I remember that idea.
That's pretty good, man.
Thanks again, and keep it juiced.
Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Ron.
Stay safe there, dude.
Ron, you're an OG, man. Thank you, Ron.
Yeah, thank you, Ron. Thank you very much.
Ron.
And thank you for listening. Thank you so much. Go ahead and follow the boys at Joji Weber, at
Mr._Molecule.
Mr. Molecule.
Yes.
Yeah, go follow Tristan. Check out his stuff.
And remember to send us your road trip snacks for us to review.
That's right. That's P.O. Box 84, Inglewood, California, 90306. And we will see you next time.